All right, welcome back everyone to another deep dive. This time we're going to be looking at Alabama law through the lens of two cases that are both, and this is purely coincidental, both involve parties named Purvis.
It's wild, right? I mean, what are the odds? Two completely different areas of law, both pretty important for, you know, understanding the Alabama legal landscape and both involving somebody named Purvis. I don't think I've ever seen anything quite like it in my research.
Yeah. And for folks who might not be super familiar with the intricacies of Alabama law, you know, sometimes these principles can feel a bit abstract, right? So we're aiming to make them really concrete for you all.
Yeah.
Especially for our law students out there.
Absolutely. Got to make it practical. And that's really what we're going to do today. We're taking a two-pronged approach. First, we're going to dive deep into the idea of sovereign immunity, particularly how it plays out when we talk about law enforcement. We'll use a case called, you guessed it, Ex Parte Purvis to illustrate that. Then we'll shift gears a little bit. We'll look at the whole question of court orders, specifically the rule, and you know this one comes up a lot, the rule that says you got to obey them even if you think they're bogus, the collateral bar rule. We'll use Purvis v. Waterworks Board to break that down.
All right. So sovereign immunity versus having to obey court orders. Two sides of the same Purvis coin. Let's kick things off with the first case, Ex Parte Purvis. This one's from back in 1980. Before we even get into the legal arguments, what was the situation that landed this case in front of the Alabama Supreme Court? What happened?
So Ex Parte Purvis, you've got a sheriff and his deputy in Mobile County. Now, the heart of the matter is this guy, Jimmy Witt, known troublemaker. Actually had a record, a history of violence, specifically against law enforcement. So he's out and about, and a be on the lookout, a below has been issued. One of the deputies actually runs into Witt.
Oh, so they had him right there.
They did. But, and this is where things get messy, he didn't arrest him. And shortly after, Witt goes and does what everyone was afraid of. He attacks a woman named Donna Akers. Brutally. Seriously injured her.
Oh, that's awful.
So it's a terrible situation. And naturally, you know, Ms. Akers and her husband, they're looking for someone to hold accountable. So they decide to sue. They sue the sheriff. They sue the deputy. Their argument was basically twofold. One, negligence, plain and simple. Two, something they call willful conduct, essentially saying that the officers knew this guy was dangerous and just let him walk.
And I assume the trial court had to sort through those claims.
They did. And they ended up dismissing some of the claims, but they allowed the willful conduct piece to move forward. And that's what brought the whole thing up to the Alabama Supreme Court.
So the big issue, the heart of the appeal, was whether Sheriff Purvis and his deputy could actually be sued at all, whether the state's idea of sovereign immunity protected them in this very specific situation.
Exactly. And the court really had to grapple with that, you know, balancing the idea of justice for the victims with the principle of sovereign immunity. And ultimately, they sided with the officers. They said, yep, sovereign immunity applies. You can't sue them.
So immunity wins out. Walk me through that, though. How did they arrive at that decision? What were the legal building blocks?
Well, the foundation, the bedrock of their decision goes all the way back to the Alabama Constitution, specifically Article 1, Section 14. This is where they lay out the whole idea of sovereign immunity. And the court was very clear that sheriffs, and because of how the law works, their deputies too, they're considered state officers. That's the key. And because they're state officers, that constitutional provision, Section 14, kicks in and gives them, in their words, absolute sovereign immunity. As long as they're doing their jobs, as long as they're acting within what the law calls the scope of their employment, they can't be held personally liable.
So that phrase, scope of their employment, that's doing a lot of work here. How did the court interpret that in the context of Ex Parte Purvis? I mean, you could argue both ways, right?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But for the court, it was pretty clear cut. They said the sheriff and the deputy, everything they did, handling the information about the fugitive, the deputy running into Witt but not arresting him, it was all part of their official law enforcement duties. They were acting on behalf of the state, carrying out the tasks that they're supposed to do as agents of the state, so immunity applied.
Now, I know there's always a lot of talk about exceptions to immunity, especially when you're dealing with, let's say, really egregious actions, really bad behavior. How did that factor into the court's decision? I mean, the Akers did allege willful conduct. Did the court address that at all?
Oh, yeah, they did. The court acknowledged that there is this exception for willful misconduct.
Yeah.
They didn't deny that. But here's the catch, and it's a big one. To prove willful misconduct, you've got to clear a pretty high bar. You have to show, and the court emphasized this, you have to show that the officers acted in bad faith, like they were deliberately doing something wrong, or that they acted with malice, like they intended to cause harm,
right,
or that they totally stepped outside the bounds of their authority. It can't just be an honest mistake, a lapse in judgment, even negligence. You get to prove that they knew they were doing wrong, or they were so reckless that it was basically the same thing.
And in this case, with the Akers, the court found that they didn't meet that burden of proof.
Right. The evidence they presented wasn't enough to convince the court that the sheriff and deputy had crossed that line into willful misconduct. And the court went even further. They said, and this is a key point, they said that sovereign immunity isn't just some procedural technicality. It's not just a loophole. It's a substantive right. It's embedded in the state constitution because, and they spelled out their reasoning here, because law enforcement officers, they need to be able to do their jobs, enforce the law, make decisions in the heat of the moment without constantly worrying about being sued every time something goes wrong. As long as they're acting in good faith, the state has their back. Of course, this protection doesn't cover actual bad actors, folks who intentionally abuse their power, but the burden to prove that, like we said, is pretty steep.
So the big takeaway from Ex Parte Purvis is that in Alabama, if you want to sue a law enforcement officer for something they did while on duty, you've got a really tough road ahead. You've got to prove that their actions were so far outside the lines that it qualifies as willful misconduct, and that's not an easy thing to do.
Exactly right. You've got to connect the dots in a very specific way.
Mm-hmm.
And even then, you're up against this foundational principle of sovereign immunity that the courts take very seriously.
Okay, so that's Ex Parte Purvis and sovereign immunity. Pretty big implications for anyone interacting with law enforcement in Alabama, really highlights how the state has chosen to protect its officers. Now, let's switch gears. You mentioned another Purvis case, and this one, from what I understand, deals with a very different set of legal principles. It's about the power of court orders and whether you can just ignore them if you don't like them.
Yep, this is Purvis v. Waterworks Board. Fast forward a few years. And this one, it really gets into the whole idea of, can you disobey a court order if you think it violates your constitutional rights?
Right. A classic legal dilemma. Right. And it sounds like in this case, Mr. Purvis decided to test those waters. So what happened? Who is this Purvis and what got him into hot water, so to speak?
So this Purvis, different guy, obviously. He was a union leader at the Birmingham Water Works Board. Big advocate for the union, pushing for recognition, collective bargaining rights, the whole nine yards. Even wanted them to collect union dues right out of paychecks. The Waterworks Board, well, they weren't exactly thrilled about this. And when Purvis threatened to strike, they took it seriously. Seriously enough to go to court and get a temporary restraining order, a TRO, to stop the strike.
And their argument was that a strike would cripple essential water services to the entire city.
Exactly. Public health and safety, that was their big concern. And the court agreed, at least initially. They granted the TRO without even holding a full hearing with evidence and witnesses and all that. Purvis got officially served with the order, no strike, but he went ahead and organized picketing anyway.
I'm guessing that didn't go over so well with the judge.
Not at all. The court found him in contempt for violating the TRO. Three separate counts of contempt for three different picketing events. Slapped him with a 15-day jail sentence, plus fines. He ended up serving 8 days before the Alabama Supreme Court stepped in and put a pause on the sentence while his appeal is being considered. But here's the interesting part. Instead of directly appealing the contempt finding or saying, hey, that TRO was bogus, Purvis filed a petition for a writ of habeas corpus.
Habeas corpus. Okay, so for our listeners who might not remember their con law class, habeas corpus is basically a way to challenge your detention, to say, I'm being held illegally. So Purvis is saying, my jail time is unlawful because the TRO itself was unconstitutional. It violated my rights. Is that right?
That's exactly it. He went for the root of the issue, challenging the basis for his contempt finding rather than the finding itself.
A bold move. So the question before the Alabama Supreme Court became whether you can essentially ignore a court order, even a temporary one like a TRO, if you have a good faith belief that it steps on your constitutional rights and then use habeas corpus to fight it out later.
And the court's answer was a resounding no. They upheld this bedrock legal principle called the collateral bar rule.
Okay, break that down for us. What exactly does the collateral bar rule mean and how does it apply to Purvis's situation?
The collateral bar rule basically says that court orders, even if you think they're completely wrong, even if you think they violate your rights, you got to follow them until they're properly challenged and overturned. You can't just decide which orders you like and which ones you don't. If everyone did that, the whole legal system would fall apart.
It makes sense on a practical level, right? Upholding the authority of the courts. But there must be some exceptions, right? I mean, what if the court order is just completely outlandish?
Oh, there is an exception. It's a narrow one, but it exists. You don't have to obey an order if it's what they call transparently invalid. Like if it's so obviously wrong, so outside the court's power, that no reasonable person could argue otherwise.
Can you give us a concrete example of what transparently invalid might look like?
Yeah. Imagine, you know, if a traffic court, the kind that deals with speeding tickets, suddenly orders someone to pay alimony in a divorce case. That's clearly outside their jurisdiction, their authority. Or if a court orders someone to do something that's physically impossible, like fly to the moon, those are pretty transparently invalid. But in Purvis's case, while the TRO did put restrictions on picketing and free speech is a big deal under the First Amendment, the Alabama Supreme Court didn't see it as transparently invalid. They reasoned that the state had a legitimate interest in making sure the water kept flowing and protecting public health and safety.
So even though the TRO did limit Purvis's freedom of speech, the state's need to prevent a disruption of essential services was enough to make the order, in the court's eyes, valid at least on its face. Meaning, he couldn't just ignore it.
Exactly. The court said that if he really believed the TRO was unconstitutional, he should have gone through the proper channels, file a motion to get rid of it, appeal it, something like that. He chose to just disobey it, and the collateral bar rule, it's kind of like a legal consequence for that choice. You can't ignore an order and then later try to argue that it was invalid all along.
So the lesson here is that if you're facing a court order in Alabama, even if you think it's wrong, your best bet, legally speaking, is to fight it through the system, not by simply ignoring it.
Absolutely. And the court really hammered that home. They even quoted this idea that in the fair administration of justice, no man can be judge in his own case, basically saying you can't decide for yourself which laws to follow.
Makes sense. So two Purvis cases, two very different legal concepts, but both with some pretty weighty implications for how the law works in Alabama. Let's pull back a bit and try to connect the dots here. What are the key distinctions between these two cases, and is there any sort of common thread running through them?
I think the biggest difference is who these legal principles are designed to protect. In Ex parte Purvis, it's the state and its actors, the sheriff and the deputy, who are shielded from liability by sovereign immunity. In Purvis v. Waterworks, it's the authority of the courts themselves that's being protected by the collateral bar rule.
And in both cases, it seems like the courts are prioritizing the smooth functioning of the legal system over the immediate concerns of the individual involved. In Ex parte Purvis, it's about allowing law enforcement to do their jobs without fear of constant lawsuits. In Waterworks, it's about making sure people obey court orders, even if they disagree with them.
That's a great observation. And it highlights this tension between individual rights and the need for order and stability within the legal system.
Now, we've talked a lot about the general rules, but what about the exceptions? Are there any situations where someone can successfully challenge state action or defy a court order in Alabama?
There are, but the exceptions are pretty limited. With sovereign immunity, you've got that high bar of proving willful misconduct. You have to show bad faith, malice, or actions that were clearly outside the scope of lawful authority. It's not enough to just show that the officer made a mistake or was negligent.
And with the collateral bar rule, the only real escape hatch is proving that the court order was transparently invalid, meaning it was so obviously beyond the court's power that it's basically a legal nullity. But simply believing the order is wrong or unconstitutional isn't good enough.
Exactly. So for all you aspiring lawyers out there, the big takeaway from these cases is this. If you've got a client in Alabama who wants to challenge state action or a court order, don't advise them to just ignore it. Don't go for the self-help remedy. Focus on finding the proper legal channels to challenge it. File a lawsuit, make the arguments, appeal the order, work within the system. That's where you're going to have the best chance of success in Alabama.
It sounds like in Alabama, procedural correctness, knowing the rules of the game, is just as important as the substance of the legal argument itself.
Absolutely. These two cases are a great reminder that in the legal world, how you do things can be just as important as what you're arguing.
So to wrap things up, what are the key takeaways we want our listeners to walk away with from our deep dive into these two Purvis cases? What's the core message here?
Well, first, remember that sovereign immunity and the collateral bar rule, they're two separate legal concepts. They serve different purposes, but they both have a big impact on the legal landscape in Alabama. And second, remember that in both of these areas, knowing and following the proper procedures is absolutely crucial. You can have the best legal argument in the world, but if you don't play by the rules, you're going to face an uphill battle in Alabama.
So much to think about there, but I do want to briefly touch upon some of the nuances we've uncovered here. For instance, Alabama's sovereign immunity is rooted in the state's constitution, which, as we know, makes it potentially more potent than the federal idea of qualified immunity, which comes from, well, statutes passed by Congress.
Great point. And don't forget about that transparently invalid standard for court orders. That bar is really high. It's not enough to just disagree with the order. It has to be so clearly wrong that it basically jumps off the page.
Right. It has to be a real head scratcher, something no reasonable judge would ever issue. And I think both of these doctrines, when you step back and look at them together, they really showcase how the law tries to balance competing interests. On one hand, you have individual rights, the right to sue the government, the right to challenge court orders. But on the other hand, you have the need for a stable and effective legal system, a system where the state can function without being bogged down by lawsuits and where court orders actually mean something.
Yeah, it's that constant push and pull, the balance between individual liberties and the need for a functioning society. Fascinating stuff. And it leads to a final thought that I want to leave our listeners with.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen how these legal principles, sovereign immunity and the collateral bar rule, they create significant protections for the state and for the authority of the courts.
Yeah.
So the question I want you to ponder is this. How do these protections, these legal shields, ultimately impact the pursuit of justice in Alabama? How do they affect the average person's ability to hold the powerful accountable, to challenge authority when they believe it's being misused? It's a complex issue, a conversation that goes beyond just these two cases, but it's something worth thinking about as you continue your legal journey.
Really makes you think about the bigger picture, doesn't it?
It does, and that's what we're all about here, getting people thinking, getting people engaged with the law.
Exactly. All right, everyone, that's a wrap on another deep dive. Until next time.